This week on Reality Check, we have a homegrown author and political animal, Gregory Christensen. He's just finished a new book called Make America Stronger Together Again. And we're here to get the inside story of his experiences in the Clinton campaign and also the current situation in Washington and what to do about it. That's this week on Reality Check on KCIW. Hi, Gregory.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Yes, thank you for coming. So let's start at the beginning. You graduated Brooking Harbor High School in 2010.
Yes, absolutely. Go Bruins. It's been a while, but hopefully they're still doing as well as they were back in the day.
So how did you get from there to the Clinton campaign? What was your path?
My friends from BHHS will remember back during the Obama White House and the elections leading up to it, I was a big supporter. And before that, was a supporter of Hillary in the primary. And so I kind of thought one day she would try it again, try running again after losing to Barack Obama in 2008. And so when she did, when she announced, I was really excited to have a role in the campaign, whatever I could do to help to elect the first woman president of the United States.
Right. So what's the mechanics of getting involved at that level? How did you do that? Did you move somewhere or sign up somewhere?
So at the time, I was still going to school at Oregon State University in Corvallis, and I had been volunteering with a political action committee called Ready for Hillary that was fundraising and trying to get the word out about Secretary Clinton, or then Secretary Clinton, and what she was going to do for the country should she be elected, and what she could bring from a different perspective beyond other candidates that were being talked about at the time. And a friend of mine who worked at Ready for Hillary said, hey, we're kind of moving on to the campaign. Would you want to be involved with the campaign finance committee, which is really a volunteer-led group? It's not a paid position on the campaign. And the job of being a hill raiser, as they were called, were people that are hopefully going to raise some money for the campaign efforts and build up a donor base for the Clinton campaign. So that was pretty much my involvement officially in the campaign. Beyond that, I certainly traveled across the country and talked with people about Hillary, about her message for the country, and how we can make America stronger together.
So where were you doing this physically?
Originally in Corvallis, but I traveled in Oregon and California and Washington, a little bit in Nebraska and Iowa, and met with a lot of people on plane flights in between and talking in those states as well about what our politics is like and what we could do differently.
So just trying to get a grip on, like, what's your lifestyle? Are you being, at least your travel expenses are being paid by the campaign, or...
They're not in this position. I was really more of a volunteer with the campaign, just trying to get the word out and connect with voters and talk to them a little bit about Hillary and her experiences and what she could bring to the country.
So there was maybe some kind of supervision in these Western states that you were responsible to reporting to and
absolutely.
That kind of thing?
Yep. Jan... goodness, I can't think of her last name now. It's been a few years, but a friend of mine, Jan, who had worked with Ready for Hillary, she oversaw about 25 hill raisers, and their job, again, was to connect some donors with the campaign and to help to generate funds. So
that's hill raiser as in Hillary raiser.
Hill raiser as in Hillary
raiser. It's
hard
to tell exactly what you're saying sometimes.
H-I-L-L raiser. But
but that's cute, actually. So you're doing this, and you did that right up to the actual election, or did you transfer into some other role?
Yeah, right up to the actual election. Also made many, many calls with voters across the country, talking with people from Florida and North Carolina, Arizona, anywhere where we could to get out the vote and try and get as many people to the polls, especially in areas that are battleground states where it would be a close call, and we were hoping to have a good turnout. And so... It was fascinating to hear what people's stories were of knowing Hillary Clinton as a political icon, someone that they looked up to, listening to some older women who said, you know, I was alive at the time when, you know, women couldn't vote. And to be able to watch the first female candidate to lead a major party in a presidential campaign, and what they believed and what I believed at the time would be the first female president of the United States. It was pretty phenomenal to watch.
Yeah. Did you drop out of school to do it?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. No. Good. So what was it that really got you motivated to be that committed to the campaign? I mean, what was it that you saw in Hillary that you thought was so unique and wonderful?
I always saw in Hillary Clinton a lot of my mother. She's this very strong woman, doesn't need to have a man tell her what to do. She's going to go out there and do what she thinks is right, what she knows is right. She's very educated and more qualified than anyone else that had run for office in the past.
She was.
I saw a lot of similar attributes to that with my mother, who's also a very strong, independent woman that's always worked very hard and pushed for her children to act the same way, to work hard for everything that they wanted in life and to never give up and never stop fighting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I know your mom a little bit, and that certainly does seem to sum her up pretty well. Okay, so you're going along, you're making phone calls, you're fundraising in various ways, and then it becomes almost the election. Can you describe a little bit about what you were going through as sort of an insider with your contemporaries that were also doing that kind of work with you? You came up thinking this was a done deal, you were going to win, and then didn't. What was
Absolutely.
That like? What was the experience?
You know, it was very interesting because I definitely believed we were going to win up until the night of the election, as the numbers started to move away from us and go in a different direction. But based on internal polling that the campaign had and information that they were pushing out to those of us that were working or affiliated with the campaign, and again, I was mainly in a volunteer capacity, so I didn't have access to all of the polling data that paid staffers and those in the closest circle would have. But the information that they were sharing with us showed that they thought they were in a strong position, that they would do very well. In the last few days, it certainly seemed like there was a potential for some states to slip over to the other side, but certainly not in a landslide way, as eventually happened in the Electoral College. And so it was definitely interesting, devastating for a lot of us that had worked for a long time and had dreamt also for a long time of that moment when we would finally shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling in the country. But you know, I can't almost even describe it in words. I try to describe it a little bit in my book and give people an insight into what I was thinking and what others were based on the stories I've heard from my friends that worked on the campaign, those who are in the inner circle, and certainly the more public stories as well about how the feelings of angst as Donald Trump was ascending into that highest office that we had believed for so long was headed in the direction of another Clinton administration. So.
And it was really, I think the Comey thing at the last minute was probably gave us all pause. Everybody who thought, oh, this is going to be a done deal. And then that came up and it was like, so many people are just, you know, buying into that as being a real thing.
Yeah.
And it was so right before the polls opened, you know.
Absolutely. Every election cycle, there seems to be what they call an October surprise.
October surprise.
And that's exactly what the Jim Comey letter to Congress was, saying that we're reopening the investigation into Hillary's emails because of emails that were found on Anthony Weiner's computer. And, you know, for a lot of us, we were not surprised because we'd been talking about emails for the better part of the last year and a half. And,
right.
You know, there's always been controversy and questions around Hillary Clinton, good or bad, about her experiences and her life in the public spotlight. So it wasn't too surprising, but at the same time, what was surprising was the other stories that were being covered up, stories that Russia was having their hands involved in the election somehow and sharing information with WikiLeaks and other details that were coming out at the same time that unfortunately were shadowed by this overwhelming news from the FBI director.
It was so strange, too, because I think Comey is probably, on the whole, a pretty good guy, but why did he do that? It was such an off-the-wall And totally against the mores of his profession, which he knew backwards and forwards.
Right, so. Yeah. There's it's a kind of unwritten rule of 60 days before a major election that there's not to be any release of information or news information that could be damaging to either side with the hopes of not affecting the outcome of the election, but allowing a legitimate election to take place. And it's not up to me to decide whether or not that was, you know, a breach of that unwritten rule. That's going to be up to the historians as we look back at it. But it certainly seems that it was out of place for Jim Comey based on his experience in the FBI up until then. But it definitely played an impact. And as Hillary has said herself, that was probably the one of the leading causes of her loss in the Electoral College at the end.
Yeah. So amazing. So you know, we kind of all know what everybody was feeling, I think, going up to the election, that, you know, there was this confidence and then there was this incredible disappointment and shock. What was it like for you personally when it didn't happen? I mean, you must have gone through some stuff being so committed.
It was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking. I'm not ashamed to say that I cried a lot. For I think a lot of us, we stared at the screens in front of us and were just in absolute shock, just gobsmacked by what had happened and totally without words. And, I remember very the feelings of anger and frustration, knowing that someone had pretty much stolen something from me because that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
You know, as you look back on it now with new details and new facts, and you can have a different perspective and kind of see it from a different lens. But with new details that we see every day and the things that are showing up on the news, it just brings you back to that time and kind of thinking about it. And then, you know, the day after was pretty hard for a lot of us, too. Waking up, was this all just a horrible dream? You know, was this a nightmare that was just out of place with everything that we thought would ever happen? And unfortunately, that nightmare for some of us just became our reality. And for other people, they were happy about the turnout. And I can understand why. It was a very close election. It was very touch and go, very hostile at many times, very angry, fear-based, but very passionate. And so a lot of people on the other side certainly had some different feelings than I did. But ultimately, I think we've all been looking back every so often at November 8th and the days leading up to it and thinking about how things would be different if it had gone a different way.
Yeah, sure would be. So what did you actually do physically? Did you come back to Brookings and, you know, lick your wounds for a while, or?
At the time, I was actually in Brookings on election night. I was here. And in fact, in the days leading up to the election, actually the few months before, my family had erected a few signs in support of Hillary on some of our property in front of our house. And they were defaced in multiple ways. Some were they threw paint on one or on two of them, and they tore up another one. And so on election night, I actually spent most of the night taking down the remaining signs that we had fixed and replaced and that my mother and I had hand-painted over where they had, you know, thrown black paint on them, because we were like, you know, our final thing, we're gonna take these signs down before someone can kind of deface them after the election and whatnot. So it was... It was definitely a tearful night, definitely one I don't like to look back and remember, but I do talk about it a little bit in the book. I write about my feelings and certainly the feelings that I believe a lot of Americans had on that night.
Well, writing a book about it, and of course in the book it's half about what happened then and sort of a recap of everything, and half about what you think would help pull the country together again, which I think is wonderful sentiment. But what I'm trying to get to is it's just so proactive of you to sit down and write a book about all of that. And how did you come to see that that was the thing to do, because I think there's maybe something to be learned in there for everybody.
I think like most of the folks, you know, across Curry County and everyone in Oregon, everybody really across the nation, I've been glued to the TV, you know, watching the daily news developments, what's happening in Washington, D.C., what's happening with folks across our country as they came out and protest and march and really speak against this president in many ways, and the way that the administration has pushed back the policies that they've supported that have really brought a lot of news attention to the political sphere that we maybe didn't have in years past. Mm-hmm. And like anyone in watching that, someone that was involved in the campaign, someone that wanted to see America in a different light, and that really believes we can return to the shining city on the hill that Ronald Reagan envisioned, I wanted to do a quick recap of the election, which ultimately became about half of the book because it was just hard to put it all in
so much
into one book. So much happened that led to that election. And then to see how we could potentially move beyond it, how we could bring the country back together again. The division, I think, is just a sad reality of this election, but one that we can certainly overcome by going back to politics that we practiced before in the days where it was okay to disagree with someone, but you didn't have to hate them or you know, want something bad to happen to them. You could just say, I disagree with you, I wish you well, I can't really wish you luck in your election, but I don't have, you know, anything bad to say about you. I don't have any, you know, ill wishes for you. I just disagree with you on this position, and this is why, and maybe we can find some common ground somewhere. Mm-hmm. So that's really what the second half of the book's about.
So I trying to get a take on, you're a millennial, which is, we were talking before we started, the biggest group, even bigger than the baby boomers, so that you have a huge amount of power. And from my perspective, it looks to me like the millennials are just being so politically active, and it's really inspiring. I mean, we didn't know anything about politics. Well, I'm speaking for my whole generation. I probably shouldn't do that, but certainly I didn't back when. I mean, politics was like, oh, that's so boring. But you folks are just really grabbing the bull by the horns in every conceivable way. And so I'm trying to get a take on, you were active when Hillary was in the primary against Obama back 8 years prior to that. How old would you have been then?
I was in high school at the time. I think I was a sophomore in high school, sophomore, junior, when she was running 2007 and 08. And I wasn't really involved with the campaign. I was the Hillary Clinton advocate at Brookings Harbor High School.
Right.
And I was, like, I guess of the group, I was the president, the vice president, everything, because I was alone in that effort.
Yeah. But, was it your mother's influence that got you involved in politics so early, or?
I don't know if it was her influence. She's a teacher or has been a teacher and always tried to give people the truthful answer, not necessarily a biased political answer. Tried to go the straight and narrow as much as possible when she was teaching. Our family has gone back and forth between being registered Republicans and Democrats, and has voted for both over the generations. But my great-grandmother was a suffragette, and my family has a long line of very strong women, which I think certainly would have put me in a position to support Hillary Clinton. And yeah. Just seeing a little bit of my mother, a little bit of my grandmother and great-grandmother in her. So
it's probably the family tradition, really, for you to get involved. Because earlier than that, presidential election-wise, you would have been in eighth grade when Bush got his second term.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that would have been pretty young to be too aware of what was going on.
Right.
So.
My first election memory was Bush v. Gore. And remember, I had a map of the U.S. that had all the electoral college numbers on it, and for each state, however many electors there were. And I would shade it in as the news came in. And I remember how long that night was, slowly shading in red and blue and Florida didn't get shaded in for a couple of weeks, but ultimately got a red shade added to it. And, you know, it's when Kerry ran against Bush 4 years later, I remember a little bit more of that election, but mainly election night. The election night coverage in the news is what I remember from most elections. And yeah. Sadly, it's also my most horrific memory, in my opinion, of this most recent election, but one that certainly is ingrained in my memory forever.
Well, getting back to the decision to write the book, was that something that was just more or less you weren't thinking about writing a book, but just writing for your own sake? Or how did you come to actually sit down and write a book? That's so impressive.
I've always enjoyed writing, and I do a quick shout out to another BHHS staple, Kathleen Raley, who is my English teacher for my freshman and my junior year at BHHS. And she and I used to talk a lot during breaks and lunch. Mm-hmm. It would just be the two of us and talking about current events and things that were absolutely unrelated to the English classes that she would teach. But she always told me, you know, have a good vocabulary. That's the most important thing, and use it whenever you can. And I've learned so many words from her. I can't even imagine. She's a walking dictionary. But ever since then, and I've really enjoyed writing. I wrote a lot in college as part of my master's program as well. And so this just seemed like the natural thing to do in my pastime, to write a little bit here and there about things that I was interested in. I didn't set out to write a book originally. And then when I got the idea, oh, I might write a book, but I'll write it on my thoughts on certain issues and what I think we should do on issues like education or equality and so forth. And that just didn't seem to come together as quickly as my thoughts on the election and on how our country needs to move forward, looking towards more cooperation and collaboration instead of the divisive politics that we see today. So,
okay, I'm going to do my traditional dumb question, because you're talking about your vocabulary, and you wrote me some lines here, and there was a word I didn't know, and we should all learn these things when we can, I guess.
Put me on the spot.
I am. No, let's see. Where is it? There it is. Kakistocratic.
Oh, kakistotic.
Kakistotic,
yeah.
Okay, tell me what kakistotic means.
Yeah, kakistotic, it's based on a kakistocracy, which is a government that's led by people that are political neophytes, or they're individuals that don't know what they're doing. So I talk a little bit in the book about an administration, which is a kakistotic administration, one that is filled with cabinet secretaries and other individuals that are in positions of great power and are leading departments and agencies across our government that don't have a lot of experience in that field or in public service at all. And the importance of making sure that when we elect someone and the people that those individuals who we do elect appoint, that they be the best and most qualified individuals for the job. So when you have an energy secretary that originally had called for 4 years prior to get rid of the Department of Energy and doesn't understand that the DOE oversees our nuclear arsenal, that might not be the best person for the job.
Yeah.
I don't want to put my bias onto any of the cabinet secretaries, I guess, other than the Department of Energy, which it just did. But
there's a bunch of them that would qualify.
Yeah, it's important to make sure you have the best people for the job. And if they don't understand the organization that they're leading, or they don't have the background for the job, then our democracy quickly moves towards a kakistocracy. And that's not an area that America wants to be in.
Yeah. So we're kind of moving into the solution side of your book, which I thought was very interesting. Right now, it seems like one of the things about your book that is so relevant is that you're talking about a return to civility. And as of the McCain funeral and then the dropping of the subsequent books from our book from Woodward, and then the release of the op-ed to the New York Times by Anonymous, seems like there's a feeling of really rejecting this hardball kind of politics we've been involved in, and people wanting to get back to what we think of as traditional American values of being civil, even when we don't agree, that kind of thing. And that seems to be a big theme in your book.
Yeah, I like probably most of your listeners would like to see a time where we can return to the level of civility that our founding fathers envisioned for our country. If you look at some of the conversations that the framers of the Constitution had back in the day, and unfortunately we don't have any audio or video recordings, that wasn't available then, but their writings between each other were written so eloquently when they disagreed on something. And those traditions passed on to the Senate, where we still today see senators say, "My good friend from the great state of," insert state name here, you know, where they try and find a way of a more civilized discussion, a little bit better exchange between the two.
Being respectful.
A little bit more respectful, yeah. And we don't see that when we talk to people just on the streets, on Main Street America. You know, you see people waving flags and people protesting and yelling and screaming at each other on TV on almost a seemingly daily basis. There's a protest somewhere in the country where someone is yelling at someone, saying some obscenity because of who that person voted for. In 2016, the election seems to be connected very closely to that. Were you a Trump supporter? Were you a Hillary Clinton defender? What were you during the election? Because however you voted then is who you are now. And if you voted for the other guy or the other gal, I don't want to have anything to do with you. And that's the kind of mentality that I think our founding fathers would really be ashamed of. And so, yeah, I do try and write a little bit about that. John McCain, as you mentioned, is a great example of someone who was willing to put politics aside, to step across the aisle and do what he knew was right, even if his own party didn't agree with him. And I have many memories of John McCain over his political career, and things that I've read about, that I've watched video clips, and things I've seen live with the rest of the country when he took a maverick step and said, "I'm breaking with my party because I'm going to do what's right for the people of my state, what I think is right for the people of the country." And that's really what we need to get back to. I'm a quintessential Democrat, absolutely, but I also think we can find times where we say, "I don't need to call myself a Democrat. You don't need to call yourself a Republican. We can just call ourselves Americans and we can find a way to work together."
Yeah, you were talking about in the book about country first, party second. How do you make that happen?
I think it's all about two things. It's about listening, and then it's about communicating. If we don't listen to each other, if we don't at least attempt to hear what the other side has to say, we'll just keep babbling off nonsense that no one else is listening to. And then we do have to have a good dialogue. So that involves mutual respect across the board. Unfortunately, we don't see that a lot in our politics today. But it really is. It's about listening. And I look back at the 2016 election and the two different candidates and how their styles were different. And I allude to this in the book as well. Hillary Clinton held a lot of events across Iowa and the plains and the heartland of the country, where she talked with individual voters in coffee shops or had town hall meetings and took questions from kids and from adults and from the 99-year-old woman that showed up in her walker and with a sign, you know, taped to it that said that she was going to vote for the first female president. And then you flash forward to where we're at today, where congressmen are constantly saying no to their constituents over town hall meetings that the community has called for. And it's interesting because we do need to be having those conversations. But unfortunately, the other candidate that ran in 2016 held big rallies and didn't really have the one-on-one conversations.
Wasn't really a dialogue, but more of a monologue.
Exactly. And as a result, I think a lot of Republicans and even some Democrats as well have taken that same approach to how they run in politics. Say, if it worked for Donald Trump, maybe it can work for me. But I do think that we need to move more towards the town hall meetings, be able to have one-on-one conversations. One thing I love about Oregon senators, both Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley, they both will have a town hall meeting every year in every county of the state. And I think every senator in across our country in every state should do the same thing. Beyond that, you know, it's just about having a good dialogue with your friends and your family, being able to talk about politics again. I've always said everything that we do, everything that we are a part of in life is political, because there's a policy somewhere that allows us to do it or doesn't, or in some way affects what we would do. And so you have to be able to talk politics with your friends, with your family. And after the 2016 election, people couldn't even go to Thanksgiving dinner because they didn't want to hear what, as the axiom goes, the racist uncle had to say, or what the Hillary Clinton supporter that was wearing the pink hat was going to give to them in some sort of speech about how they're doing things wrong. Both sides were like, hey, I'm going to steer clear of Thanksgiving dinner this year, and maybe I'll just go out to eat. That's not good for anybody. I think we need to be able to have a healthy conversation back and forth. What Brookings will remember me as was my career in 4-H growing up as a kid in elementary and high school. And I always tried to enter as many projects as I could in the local fair. And sometimes I didn't have any competition, and it wasn't any fun because I was competing against myself. And when I had really tough competition from my peers, that's when it really brought out the best in me as a competitor. And I worked really hard, and I tried to do my absolute best because I wanted to see if there was any way that I could eke out a win this time. And so I think if we can go to a point where we have healthy debate in our country, where both sides really have to have a back and forth dialogue, a thrust and parry, then we'd be able to get things done. At least we'd be able to have a conversation about it and know where they stand on the issues.
Well, so what other kinds of things do we need to make happen? I mean, substantial, specific changes that we could work toward that would help our dialogue?
You know, I've talked to voters across the country. I love talking about politics, and it's very quick that any conversation I have turns somehow to politics. And one thing that people always are telling me is how frustrated they are with the fact that we have two parties in this country, and you're either red or blue, you're either Republican or a Democrat. I think we need to stop associating ourselves with just a party, and maybe associate ourselves as Americans, kind of get away from saying I'm liberal or I'm conservative, but I'm just like you. I'm an everyday American, and I'm ready to negotiate on the issues with you. I'm ready to have a discussion, and sometimes I'm going to be right, sometimes I'm going to be wrong, but I don't have all the answers. And I can learn something from you. And I think that's an important aspect of this, is we have to be able to have those conversations, to be able to say with ourselves that I don't have all the answers every time. I'm not always going to be right. My way isn't always going to be the best option. Sometimes I'm going to be wrong. And sometimes compromise is just the best answer.
So there's some specific things that I assume would be probably things that you would support, that the Electoral College was the last bunch of elections, the popular vote winner didn't win the election because of the Electoral College. And that is something carried over from more primitive times when people weren't as educated and there weren't as, wasn't as much media to keep people informed.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been five times that the Electoral College has given the presidency to the person that didn't win the popular vote. And at least in my lifetime, I've seen it twice with Bush v. Gore and then Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. And this time around, it was a matter of 3 million votes, which is a pretty substantial number of votes as opposed to the, couple thousand that we had in Florida between Gore and Bush back in 2000. But yeah, it's an archaic part of our electoral system, the Electoral College, that assigns great power to electors that most people don't know. In many states, they never have a clue who the Electoral College member is, the designee that goes and up to Salem, and at least in Oregon, goes to Salem and signs their name to a candidate based on the outcome of the election, and that gets sent off to Congress, and Congress certifies it. Unless there's some sort of a change, like we saw this last year, where a few electors broke with tradition and chose a candidate other than the one that their state had set up for them to vote. It does happen occasionally where they have the detractors and they go a different way. But if that doesn't happen, most Americans will never know who's voting on their behalf. And so that's definitely something we should get away from. Everyone's vote should count, and everyone should have the transparency of knowing that their vote is one vote for whoever they voted for, and it's not going to just go into a pool of other candidates and eventually be cited based on one elector.
I believe they have bound and unbound, or some term like that, as to whether the electors have to go with the popular vote in their state or not.
Yeah, and different states are run differently, and the bound and unbound especially applies to the delegates in the primary system, which is run a very similar way. And different states have different ways of whether it's a winner-take-all, where the person who wins the popular vote in the state takes all the delegates. Some of those are proportionally done. The Democratic Party has a very strange system for handing out delegates through their convention that involves superdelegates, which are primarily politicians within the Democratic Party that are elected politicians or formerly elected politicians.
And they're not tied to a specific state?
They're not. They're tied to the state that they reside in.
Oh, okay.
But they don't have to vote the way that the state does. And in 2016, about 400 of those superdelegates immediately endorsed Hillary Clinton before any of the first voting actually came in the Iowa caucuses and the other early states. And so to an untrained eye, it might seem like that's an unfair advantage to Hillary Clinton. There were only 700-some superdelegates, and you need over 2,000 delegates to win the nomination of a party. So you can't win by superdelegates alone. But the Democratic Party has taken some steps to remove that process or at least mitigate the potential impact of those superdelegates. But it'd be nice if we just had it where everyone's vote was counted and we counted based on the popular vote, not based on some elector.
And then there's gerrymandering, which is so confusing. I guess you redistrict everything about once every 10 years based on the census, and whatever party is in power gets to do it.
Yeah, that's basically the way that it works. The state legislature is responsible for the redistricting process. So here in Oregon, where Democrats have held the Oregon Assembly and the Oregon Senate, and where we've had a Democratic governor for a long time, you can expect that the state is going to be, for the most part, the way that the Democrats want it, because they've had the ability to change it if they so desired. But other states have either a mix, or they have a close House and Senate that occasionally flips from party control to the other, or a Republican governor in large Democratic cities within the state. Gerrymandering is a huge problem, because all you have to do is look at any district in our country, including those here in Oregon, the five districts that we have in Oregon. They don't have any square lines to them. They're very jagged edges.
Sometimes
they have
ridiculous
little islands in the middle.
It's a
political ploy that's used by parties when they're in power to hold on to that power, especially at the U.S. congressional level. It mainly affects the House of Representatives, but does have a lot to do with the Electoral College as well, and ultimately with our presidential elections.
With the Electoral College, we need a constitutional amendment, I assume, to get rid of it.
Absolutely, yeah. It is a protected aspect of our electoral process, so we would need to have a constitutional amendment, which is very difficult to do.
Very difficult.
And in fact, we rarely ever pass and ratify an amendment. The one that's probably the next step on the list, or at least hopefully so, is the ERA amendment that still needs two states to ratify. And a few of those who have already ratified have since rescinded their ratification, although we've never had that happen before, so that would go to the Supreme Court to decide if that's even possible. But it's been there for years.
And for years. Never gets passed.
Never gets
very close to passing. Since I was a kid, they've been trying to pass the ERA. Never happens.
Yeah. And so, you know, as difficult as that was, imagine trying to then take the power away from those who believe that the Electoral College is the best system. And right now, because it did just decide the election for one candidate over the other, one that did win the popular vote, there's one party in our country, the Republican Party, that has good reason to want to hold on to the Electoral College. It's what put their candidate into the White House, and to support a change to that would in many ways delegitimize his presidency, or at least make it seem like they weren't supportive of that decision that happened in 2016.
What about gerrymandering? What has to happen to change that? Do you know?
Yeah, gerrymandering is very difficult because it's not constitutionally supported at all. The term even goes back to a guy that Jerry,
right.
We didn't get too specific on the naming there, or too original, I guess, but it was because a district looked like a salamander. So that's where the second part of the word comes from. And gerrymandering is difficult to do because it does involve state legislatures and state governorships. So the best way to do that is to get out and vote. Vote for the party that you want to decide those lines and decide which district you're going to live in, because it very easily could change from one administration in a state governor's mansion to another. And that's our only means right now, because it's a state by state issue.
So in other words, the state legislature would have to pass something saying we're not doing it that way anymore and come up with some other plan.
Absolutely. And the other way that, I mean, you could fix both the Electoral College and gerrymandering too, is just through the legal system, which we're seeing a little bit now, especially in the Midwest, where former attorneys general of the United States are going after some of these states that are very heavily gerrymandered in favor of Republicans in a way that is seen by most to be unfair. Whether or not those will pan out, or whether they'll go to the Supreme Court and sit there for a few years, or just, you know, if that effort will lose steam, it's going to be up to all of us to kind of keep pressure on that in states like Wisconsin that are undergoing this right now. But we'd like to see it happen in Oregon as well. In any state in our country where these districts are nothing like what they should or what they could be, if we were to redistrict appropriately.
And also, just although recent decisions around having money in politics that could be, I guess, not really changed much unless you can go to the Supreme Court and get a different decision.
Absolutely, yeah. Citizens United was a Supreme Court decision that supports the investment of what they call dark money. It's money from political action committees, especially super PACs, that individuals can donate as much money as they'd like to, and don't have to, those super PACs then don't have to disclose the donors' names. So you have no idea where this money is coming from. And then it's able to just be dispensed into numerous campaigns across the country. Often they're not political campaigns so much as advertisements and TV spots that don't end with paid for by in a candidate's name, but is paid for by some group that sounds like it's something that you might support and
Americans
ultimately isn't.
Americans for America.
Yeah, and these vague terms can very easily trick us into believing that, oh, I'm for this, I stand by this, I think that's a good idea. Because we don't know where the money's coming from. We don't understand what everything is, because like anyone, we probably don't spend all day looking at the ballot measures that are coming up on the November election, or we aren't paying attention to everything that's happening in D.C. So it's very easy to get something by you when you have a large group of lawyers and a lot of donors that are pushing these things through. So and Citizens so, United would be a good one to overturn, and that would take a Supreme Court.
Is there anything we can do short of the Supreme Court, since it looks like it's going to be a little difficult there for a while, in terms of changing any of that, or is it really going to require the Supreme Court to make different decisions?
Very similar to the argument with guns in our country, where that is backed up by a constitutional amendment. Although Citizens United isn't in the Constitution, it has about as much strength behind it as the Supreme Court ruling. So it would be very difficult to do anything or really put a dent in it. What we can do as citizens, what all of us have the ability to do, is to donate to the organizations that we support, make contributions, you know, based on what you can afford, but also that are within the legal limit, which is $2,700 per cycle. So in a primary and in a general election, you can do $5,400 together. But and then to vote, because it's all about voting. When you look at the Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, who's before Congress right now, they're deciding on his fate, whether or not he'll be the juror to fill in for Kennedy's seat. If we vote a Senate and a House that support candidates that we like, and if we support a president that will nominate said candidates, we can get them in, because Congress is the only check and balance that we have on the Supreme Court, and the executive branch is our only way of nominating someone to the Supreme Court. So it's all about voting.
And voter suppression is also a big issue these days.
Absolutely. It's a huge one. We're seeing it all across the South, especially, you know, with this administration's policy towards immigrants and people who are different. Unfortunately, a lot of that does fall into our own lives, and that happens at the ballot box. And in these last primaries, we've seen a number of voters who were turned away because they had the same last name as someone else who voted earlier in the day. And not everyone has the last name Christensen. It's not a very common one. So when I go to the ballot box, I'm pretty much guaranteed that I'm going to be able to walk in and vote the way that I want to vote. But if your last name is Smith, or if your last name is Luis or Hernandez, or you know, your name is Mohammed, and someone thinks that, hey, I already saw someone here with that name, you might be turned away. And it's difficult. It's something that we need to look into, but it happens based on race and ethnicity. That's definitely a challenge that we need to address, and it brings up a larger issue of racial discrimination across our country, and one that apparently this administration supports.
So I know those are all things that you address in the book. Is there anything else in terms of solutions that we should be thinking about?
Well, and as I said in the book, and I've said it many times, it's all about voting. It's all about communication. I think we work best when we work together in this country. I think that means being able to communicate with each other, being able to work with each other, collaborate with each other, and to vote for one another. So that would be my final pitch, is to go out and vote. Make sure that you vote for who you feel is best. Don't vote because of the D or the R next to someone's name. Don't vote because of their party affiliation. But make sure that you know what they stand for before you get in the ballot box, or before you fill out your mail-in ballot in here in Oregon. Know what they stand for. Know what their position is on the issue. Know five things about them. If you can't say five things about the candidate, you don't know them well enough to vote for them. So learn about it, pay attention, and then vote.
That's great. I think one of the other things, maybe starting to wrap up, I'm just curious, do you have a feeling for, are we going to have an impeachment in the future, and what's going to happen in our midterms? Have you thought about that much?
Yeah, impeachment is very difficult. Obviously, we've never had the impeachment of a president that was confirmed in the Senate. Bill Clinton was impeached in the House of Representatives in the 90s, but that didn't lead to a conviction by the U.S. Senate. So it would be difficult to remove a president from office. There's obviously other ways of doing it, as was talked about in the anonymous op-ed piece in the Times. You can invoke Article 4 or 5 of the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that allows for the vice president of the United States to assume power either temporarily or permanently with support of half of the executive cabinet and the vice president. And it's anyone's guess who wrote the anonymous article. It could be one of those individuals that would eventually vote on whether or not to invoke that amendment.
Or even be
or
Pence himself.
Yeah, the vice president himself, who knows. Impeachment is, it would be a sad thing to see in our country. I don't agree with the president on many issues. I obviously didn't support him. I supported his opponent. And I've spoken out against him. I've written things in newspapers, including in the Curry Pilot here in Brookings, about this administration and the way that this president treats and looks at other people based on their differences and their values and his ideas for what our country should look like that I disagree with. But at the same time, I am not really eager to see an impeachment either. I would prefer that he follow suit with Nixon and say, you know, I wasn't the right guy for the job. I'm going to step aside. That being said, will any of that happen? Probably not. It's anybody's guess. I stopped guessing after the 2016 cycle because I knew for sure that Hillary was going to win. And when that didn't happen, I said, hey, I obviously missed something. So I don't want to make that similar assumption for a future race. But
it's so easy to listen to pundits and be swept along with their enthusiasm and their certainty about certain things.
Absolutely. And one thing we didn't even talk about, is the role that Russia's played in this election and what they're continuing to play in the upcoming midterms and likely will in future elections as well. This administration has done nothing to counteract what was done in 2016 and what has been done in many countries around the world. I write about it in the book, especially about the case for Estonia, a country in Eastern Europe where the Russian Federation under Vladimir Putin's leadership basically put into place the government that they knew would work well with what the Kremlin's agenda was. And it seems that that's the case here. I'm not saying by any means that votes were changed on election night or that anyone hacked in and changed around the numbers, but they certainly had a concerted influence campaign against my candidate, Hillary Clinton, and in favor of Donald Trump. And it looks like we're headed for that in the midterms already and in future races if we do nothing about it. So that's one of those that, like all these other topics, it's kind of hard to do as a regular American everyday. Folks can't do a whole lot to stop a foreign government from interfering in the elections in our country. But what they can do is vote for a Congress that's willing to be a check and balance on this administration, vote for a Congress that's going to push forward even more policy, as we already have, that targets Russia for their involvement in 2016 and requires them to hand over individuals who were a part of that process, and really puts the pressure on the White House to say, Americans get to decide who our president is, not Russians, not a foreign power.
And the fact that they have, the Russia, that is, has been instrumental in this sort of propaganda campaign in other countries. I mean, they don't have to necessarily manipulate the vote if they're just really good at social propaganda, which they've been working through Facebook and other media to really sway people's opinions. I mean, they're good at that. That's what they do.
Absolutely. They've done it for years. They're one of our oldest adversaries. I'm always surprised when I see people talking about Russia today. We've done almost a 180, it seems, from the days when Russia was the communist giant that we were absolutely against in every way, when it was the Soviet Union. The USSR was not our friend by any means, and the Russian Federation is not our friend either. And so it would be in our best interest as Americans, as patriots, as individuals who believe that Americans get to decide our elections and that they get to decide the fate of our country, to stand up to this president and to stand up to members of Congress who refuse to stand up to Donald Trump and say, enough is enough with this Vladimir Putin-led government. We're not going to allow our president to be puppet mastered anymore.
And so we're approaching the midterms. Any predictions?
I think we'll see a lot of the same as we've seen over the last few special elections, where there will be spots across our country that are regularly conservative strongholds that will switch in favor of Democrats or a more liberal-leaning candidate. We're seeing a lot more of the socialist wing of the Democratic Party turn out, especially with the recent election of a or a recent win in the primary in New York, where a member of the American Socialist Party beat out an incumbent Democrat for a congressional seat. And so I think we'll see more of that. Beyond that prediction, the only other thing I would say, again, not wanting to try and even guess at this election, is that we'll probably not take back the House. Democrats probably will not take back the House, probably will not take
back
the Senate. I think both of those will stay in the same place that they are right now. We might up our seats in the House, and potentially we could take it back. It would take a massive effort by Democrats across our country and everybody showing up to vote. And I hope that I'm proven wrong on that. I absolutely do. And hopefully your listeners will just be an extra part of that, calling people outside of Oregon and every state that they can to get out the vote for Democrats across the country. I'd love to be proven wrong, but it certainly seems that Congress is looking like it'll be in the same place, especially if we don't do anything. So
it's
up to everybody.
Well, that's an interesting projection.
It's up to everybody.
And you're running for, you're not running for, you're campaigning for?
I'm campaigning right now in Iowa for John Delaney. He's a congressman from Maryland, a really stand-up guy, believes very strongly in bipartisanship and recognizes the importance of working together. Big surprise, I guess, that I would support him after just writing a book on that topic myself, but supports education in our country and a massive investment in infrastructure. And I think both of those two would do well to build an America that truly is stronger together again.
And that's a great way to just give this book a little plug here, Make America Stronger Together Again by Gregory Christensen. Is it readily available on Amazon?
Absolutely. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, wherever you buy books, you can find a copy of
it. And you can get it as a soft cover and also as an ebook.
Absolutely.
And the really fascinating thing was all the places that are getting contributions based on the purchase of the book. Can you run those off real quick?
Yeah. If you buy a copy of the book, you're supporting voter outreach organizations and a few progressive groups that are really working to get out the vote in this upcoming midterm cycle. They include America Votes, Fair Vote, Let America Vote, the League of Women Voters, Onward Together, and Rock the Vote. But the list certainly goes on. I'm trying to share the profits with as many groups as I can to really help Democrats and liberals and really just Americans out across our country. So,
well, thanks so much for coming on. Again, the name of the book is Make America Stronger Again Together by Gregory Christensen. Thank you for coming. This has been Lee Tooley, your host, and Pi White, the technical support. And thank you all for listening.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.